Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and with me today is Alexander Sitkovetsky. Welcome.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Great to be here.
Pleasure having you here. We were talking about this, so let's keep talking about this a little bit, as long as we're on this topic, having to do with the difficulties, the vicissitudes of travel. And you're based in London now?
Based in London, yeah. I've been living there for 20 years now.
So as much performing as you can do in and around London, you still have to travel a lot, long trips around the world, I assume.
Yes. Well, it comes with a job.
Yeah, it comes with a job. And so what do you do if you've been traveling for a couple of days and the travel somehow affects you, your ability to play, you say? I mean, that you have no way of knowing until you've been on the plane for 12 hours, you know, how it's going to affect you.
Right. Well, I mean, the traveling itself, I actually surprisingly enjoy. I find... Airplanes can be... I hate the airports, but the actual airplanes I find quite peaceful. Once you get to them, because, you know, you have a chance to just relax, gather your thoughts. I listen to music very often. I can watch a film, just, you know, just put my mind at rest. There's no chance of emailing, of having to think about anything except just you and your own thoughts, which is very nice. But what we were talking about, of course, is what happens if sometimes you pick something up from somebody else on the flight, for example, and you arrive to the orchestra or to the hall where you're going to be playing, and somehow you get unwell, and this is always a tricky one, I think, for a musician, for a soloist to decide, you know, what to do, because in no way you never want to let down an orchestra and the conductor, and you know, you always want to play, but at the same time, if things develop and you really are not feeling well, is it sometimes better to cancel the concert for various reasons? First of all, it's not very healthy to play with a fever, because it's not good for your arms. They begin to ache after a while. You don't really practice as much as you want to, because you're just not really well enough to do that. And then sometimes the performance, you know, you do it your absolute best, but sometimes it happens that it might suffer a little bit because you're just not in the best shape. But then what do you then break the news to the orchestra one day before that you're not going to be performing, and then put them in a terrible position as well? So, you know, it's a difficult one sometimes.
A tough call, but I trust has not happened too often to you.
Thankfully not. I mean, 99% of the time I have decided to go for it with mostly good results. But it does feel a little bit extra stressful, I have to say.
But you're okay now.
I'm good to go.
Okay.
Let's touch wood that until tomorrow nothing happens.
And you'll be playing tomorrow with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, and that'll be at the Capitol Theater, the Overture Center, 8 o'clock on Friday night. And it'll be, in your case, you're playing the Beethoven Sixth, but the orchestra's playing Beethoven 6, you're playing the Beethoven Violin Concerto, and then there'll also be an unusually rarely heard work by Benjamin Britten on the program, the Beethoven Violin Concerto. I assume can be played for orchestras of various sizes, because in Beethoven's time, an orchestra was probably more like a chamber orchestra of today in size.
Absolutely, and I think very much the orchestration is still... You know, it has added a few. I mean, pretty much it adds the timpani, but apart from that, it's very much the orchestration of a Mozart concerto, for example, or of a Mozart 5 or something like that. So, I think it's a perfect size orchestra to do this work. I mean, Beethoven, his music is so great that it can be performed in so many different ways. So even if you put the biggest orchestra out there, and it's still going to sound like fantastic music. It's, you know, with different size of orchestra, you sometimes have different approaches to the interpretation. But it's, of course, I call it in some ways the godfather of the modern violin concertos, because I think it's the link from the concertos of people like Mozart and Haydn, and towards the Romantic era, and the concertos, which then went on to be by Brahms and Tchaikovsky and so on.
It's a concert hall concerto, unlike some of the others, which would have been written for smaller,
exactly. It has a very symphonic feel. I think in many ways it has very long architecture. The first movement is, you know, something like 25 minutes, which I think is definitely a first at that time. Most violin concertos were over in 25 minutes.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, as we were getting to Beethoven's time. So I think it's a real, it's not a breakthrough, but it's a true landmark piece. It's fantastic, and I'm looking forward to play it. It's always a very big challenge for a violinist, I think, and I learned the piece first when I was 16, and it's funny because when I was telling people I was learning it at 16, I thought people were saying to me, you know, it's the hardest piece. It's considered really the hardest violin concerto of all there
really?
Is to play.
Even now.
Yeah, even now, because it's so transparent in everything, and it's incredible if you really look at the scores, especially in the first movement. It's apart from some melodies, it's mostly scales and arpeggios. I mean, if you look at it in a kind of just an abstract way, it's really it's just scales and arpeggios, and yet there's so much music in them, and also the interplay between the soloist and the orchestra is one of the best, I think, in all concertos, because so many times you are accompanying the orchestra, and also the way that the, for example, in the second movement, that the solo violin plays the same theme twice, and the first time it's accompanied just by strings, and the second time it's accompanied just by woodwind, and this kind of, I think, this conversation that you get between the orchestra and the soloist, it's really a magical piece.
Well, speaking of conversations, you come from a musical family. Let's see. You have a pianist of great note, Bela Davidovich.
Yes, my great aunt. Great mm-hmm. aunt, yeah.
And let's see. You have a conductor in the family.
Yes, that's my uncle. he's also an absolutely wonderful violinist. I mean, he's now moved on. For him, conducting now is a very important part of his career. But he's still playing, and he's still playing about 100 concerts a year. So he's a busy guy.
And your mother's a pianist.
My mom's a pianist. I think because of her, I am playing the violin.
Wait a minute. Why is that? So you could play together, you mean?
I think it was, you know, I'm a third generation musician in my family. And my dad, he studied the violin until he was the age of 13 or so. But he really didn't enjoy playing it, actually, and so he stopped, and he went on to be a rock guitarist, and he was in a rock in a very well known rock band in the USSR. He lives now actually in California, but I think for my mom it was important to keep our family tradition of musicians going, and it's, you know, it was very common in USSR that generations continue to play. You know, Oistrakh, his son, was a fantastic violinist.
David and Igor.
His grandson, Valery Oistrakh, is also a violinist. The same thing with the Kogan family. They had Leonid Kogan, mm-hmm. and then you had Pavel Kogan, who was his son, who went on. He's now conducting a lot, but he is also a musician. And then his grandson, who actually I've played with, Dima Kogan, he's also a active violinist in Russia now. So it's quite normal for us to keep going. But I think my mom thought that I always showed quite a musical ear, because she says that before I started talking very late, and before I started talking, she said I was singing already. So that was a good sign.
I've heard
for her.
Of that before, you know. I believe it, among others, it was Arthur Rubinstein who talked after he played the piano. I mean, he was that precocious as a pianist,
right?
And for whatever reason, that delayed as a
speaker. Well, I mean, I wouldn't want in any way to compare myself to somebody as great as that, but I don't know why. It just was the way it was, and I think for her it was important to continue this tradition. So I was taken to my first violin lesson at the age of 5 and a half, and as always with music, you have to start early, as anybody who's playing professionally will tell you. You
know, music and language.
Yeah, you start between the age of 3 and 6 or so, and sometimes 7, but usually in Soviet Union it was, following our kind of pedagogic school, it was we would to start about 5 and a half, 6.
Well, speaking of your mother, this is you and your mother, Olga Sitkovetsky. She's at the piano, and you actually put out a CD some years ago, more than
this
10.
This is 11 years ago. This is crazy. I haven't heard this for years. I'm so scared right now to see how it's going to sound.
That's always fun, doing this with great performers, to play things that they had forgotten they recorded or had not heard for a long time. So we have decided to start with the first of five pieces from Cinderella by Prokofiev, with my guest today, Alexander Sitkovetsky, as the violinist and his mother, Olga, as the pianist. Waltz from the Cinderella Suite by Sergei Prokofiev, played by my guest today, Alexander Sitkovetsky, with his mother, Olga, at the piano. And it's 21 past 12, back with my guest and more music, and of course the quiz question in about 9 or 10 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with Alexander Sitkovetsky. And you had some trepidation before we heard this recording from 11 years ago. What did you think of it?
I spent most of the time talking to you, which was good.
I was trying to keep you distracted so you'd be more relaxed.
No, but it was nice to listen. It reminded me of the whole process. It was my first ever recording, and I remember, of course, I was very nervous, but I was lucky. I had a fantastic, really wonderful producer. His name is Max Wilcox, who's done some legendary recordings, including all of the late Arthur Rubinstein chamber music discs with the Guarneri Quartet. So, he put me at ease very, very quickly. It was an eye-opener about how to record in the studio. We had a beautiful hall. It was the Academy of Arts and Letters in New York, which was in Harlem. So the first time I was in Harlem also. And I remember eating amazing grilled cheese sandwiches in between when we had our little breaks. So it brought back a lot of nice memories.
You have a recording project in the works now?
At the moment, I'm going to record a sonata disc, but I'm not yet sure which sonatas I'm going to do. But it's going to be sometime at the end of this year. It came through a competition which I won last year in May with my duo partner and also my wife, actually. It's a wonderful Chinese pianist, Wu Chen, and we went to a duo competition in Italy, and we got the first prize, and it gave us a lot of concerts in Italy, and also we played at the Carnegie Hall this past January, just a month and a bit ago. And as part of the prize also, we get to record a record. So we're going to do a sonata disc for sure, but we haven't yet decided what we're going to put on it.
You do a lot of the sort of the iTunes thing now? I mean, so much music is being offered, not just on CD, but on these other
formats. The last couple of projects which I have done, which was... what were the last things I did? I did a Mendelssohn disc with the two early concertos, the D minor, small D minor for violin.
It was about 14 or something.
Exactly,
like that.
And then also the double with piano, which we did that with the Stuttgart Chamber Orchestra, and a wonderful pianist, Dinora Varsi. It was an amazing collaboration because I didn't know her before, and they put us, the record company or the orchestra put us together. And,
really?
And she was, she was already in her 70s then.
I wonder how they chose the two of you.
I think the orchestra had a long relationship with her, going back many, many years. And with me, they heard, I sent them a CD, and I was told to send them a CD by somebody, and it worked out. So that's how we made it. And then we did a nice disc with Julia Fischer, a wonderful violinist and a good friend of mine, and she recorded an all Bach concerto CD, and so I played a double with her on that recording. And then the last one which I did was also a chamber music disc, because for me chamber music is also a very important part for me, and I love doing it. So we did a Brahms clarinet quintet, but with a viola player playing the clarinet part.
Oh, that's
one of the
reasonable.
Really best young viola players, I think, in the world today. He's from Ukraine. His name is Max Rizanov. We live together in London, and we've known each other for 11 years, and we decided to make the CD for Onyx Records as well. And I think all of these things, they're all available on iTunes, I think.
Out there, out and about, yeah. Downloadable, that kind
I
of thing.
I think so. I think, I mean, I...
They take on lives of their own once you record
them. Exactly, exactly. It was very much... Anyway, the projects were very much... I was asked to do them, and then what happens with the CD afterwards is up to the record company to do. You know, I just try to play my best.
You send your child out into the world, and you don't know what kind of career path
there
will
kind
be
of,
for
kind
him.
Of. You just hope that, people like it.
We were talking earlier also... about Rachmaninoff rarities, and he did not write a lot of violin music, did he?
No, from what I understand, because this is going back to the first CD, which we tried to pick Russian music, but which was almost never recorded and hopefully not even often heard. And so this, for example, the Prokofiev, which you just heard, was the first movement of the five movements of the Cinderella Suite, which was from his ballet, taken from his ballet Cinderella, which of course was a very famous piece, but it was taken by a Russian violinist, Mikhail Fichtengold, and he made a transcription for violin and piano of it, which I'm very happy he did, because I think it's
yes,
a very nice arrangement.
Yes, it is.
And so there's other things there. For example, there's a piece by Ephraim Zimbalist called the Golden Rooster, which is taken from Rimsky-Korsakov's opera, and that was another transcription. There's a rare piece by Wieniawski, of course, Polish composer, but the piece is called Souvenir.
Who did write a fair amount of violin music.
Which, of course, he was most famous for writing violin music. And then, so what I think we found the only two original pieces for violin and piano by Rachmaninoff, which is a romance and also a Hungarian dance. And we think that they are maybe the only two originally written violin pieces, because of course there's the vocalese, which is played on the violin all the time,
but
it's
for voice,
obviously originally for voice. And so,
well, here's the Hungarian dance. We think of Brahms and think it might be an arrangement, but no, this is straight Rachmaninoff, and it's a Hungarian dance, early piece too, I gather, Opus 6.
Yep, I think the romance also was a very, very early piece.
And Alexander Sitkovetsky is the violinist, and his mother Olga is the pianist. Is a piece you don't hear very often. I can think of one reason. That is because there's no pushover to play. At least it certainly doesn't seem like it. It can't be just any combination of violinist and pianist who would play the Hungarian dance of Sergei Rachmaninoff, but my guest and his mother did, Alexander Sitkovetsky with Olga Sitkovetsky at the piano. And thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you for having me.